fragment of flying disc fragments to Hamilton Field, California for analysis. The disc parts were said by the informant to have come from one of the mysterious platters that nearly plunged into the Sound near Maury Island recently. The two crash survivors have said that one of their engines burst into flames and that the fire apparatus installed in the engine for such emergencies failed to function.
Smith immediately called a contact at McCord Field and learned that an Air Force transport had taken off for Alaska within the hour, but he was unable to obtain a passenger list. They were also unable to reach Chrisman at home. They called Harold Dahl, who said he had not heard from Chrisman. Then, in extreme distress, Dahl hung up after telling them he didn't want to hear from them anymore, said he was sick of the whole business, and if authorities ever asked him about it again, he would deny having seen anything in the harbor and claim it had been a hoax all along. Morello then told Arnold and Smith the following. You're involved in something beyond our power to find out anything about. I'm giving you some sound advice. Get out of this town until whatever it is blows over. I think you're nice fellows, and I don't want anything to happen to you if I can prevent it. After leaving the station, Smith and Arnold drove to Harold Dahl's address to question him one last time. When they arrived, they were shocked to find the house at the address he'd given them earlier in the week deserted and vacant, unlocked and covered with cobwebs. It was clear no one had lived there for months. Deeply shaken, the two men drove directly to McCord Field. During this trip, Arnold noticed that they were being followed by a black Buick sedan. Before leaving town, they had arranged one last meeting with an Army intelligence major at McCord. Treating the whole matter casually, the smiling officer nonetheless took all of the remaining pieces of rock Fred Chrisman had given them, saying he would be sure to have them analyzed for the sake of being thorough. Arnold still had a piece in his hand and was about to pocket it when the officer held out his hand. We don't want to overlook even one piece. I handed him my piece, said Arnold. This major was a smooth guy, but not smooth enough to convince me that these fragments weren't important in some way. I suddenly felt that no one had played a hoax on anybody. They then drove directly to the civilian airfield. Arnold flew Smith up to Seattle, dropped him off, then took off again and flew east, headed back home to Boise. This is his account of what happened next. 6. Kenneth Arnold's flight home.
The coming of the saucers. I started my airplane, warmed it up good, checked both my magnetos at full throttle, checked my gas lines, fuel valves, and so on. Everything seemed to be in perfect order. Although it was rather late in the day, it was only about a 4-hour flight to Boise. When I got the weather sequence on my radio, I knew I would have a 20 to 30 mile per hour tailwind at the higher altitudes. I was anxious to get going. I shoved the throttle clear to the instrument panel and took off, feeling a little unsteady about everything, but glad I was going home at last. As I circled the airport, I could still see Captain Smith looking up at me. I headed for home. I climbed to an altitude of 8,000 feet. I felt a lot better after crossing the Cascades and started to let down over the Columbia River with the intention of landing at Pendleton, Oregon, to get gasoline. Everything was running smoothly. I landed at Pendleton, and the boys there gassed up my airplane. I got out of the cockpit to stretch my legs, but stayed close to my plane. I signed my credit slip, and with a full gas tank, was ready to take off again for home. I wasn't tarrying, as the hours of daylight were numbered. I had navigation lights, but didn't have a battery in my ship to operate them, so I had to make it home before dark. I recall flipping my controls to indicate to the tower operator I was going to take off. The tower operator knew me and knew I had a receiver. He always came over the receiver to me if for some reason I should hold. Everything seemed fine. My plane was running well. Again, I shoved the throttle clear to the stop. My engine roared and I was off the ground. I reached an altitude which I would judge was around 50 feet. My engine stopped cold. It was as if every piston had been frozen solid. It never even gave a dying bark. To take off and have an engine stop at that low altitude is probably the most dangerous thing that can happen in an airplane. You don't have enough speed to sustain you for a normal landing. Your only choice for putting her down is straight ahead, with no power and little or no lift from your wings. Instinctively, I dove the plane straight at the ground until I must have been within 10 feet of the runway. then came back on the stick as fast as I dared in an attempt to level off without causing an abrupt stall. My little airplane came through. I was sinking fast, but I set it down on all 3 points. The shock was pretty hard. My left landing gear was badly bent, and my left spar was broken in two. At the moment, I didn't know what had happened. I thought the engine had frozen. I was unhurt. I jumped out of the cockpit, ran around to the front of the plane, and turned the propeller. It was loose and easy. People came running out to see what was the matter. I was curious to see if my engine would start again. I scooted around the wing and back into the cockpit. There I discovered what had caused my engine to stop. Until this writing, I have kept this a secret to myself. My fuel valve was shut off. I knew instantly there was only one person who could have shut that fuel valve off, and that was myself. I turned the valve back on. One of the fellows swung the propeller. My engine started immediately and ran smoothly. I taxied my plane rather limpingly into the hangar. I was scared stiff. I didn't tell anyone what had happened for the simple reason that no one would believe me. I was in no respect accustomed to turning my fuel valve off. I only did so when my plane was either leaking gas through the carburetor float or when I put it away in storage. I elected not to say anything to anyone until they had some logical reason within my mind to explain how I could do such a ridiculous thing. The care and precautions I had always exercised before taking off and which had become an established habit with me for over 3 years had somehow failed. The possibility that my thoughts or mind in some peculiar way was being controlled or dictated to do this, or that some external force could have caused this to happen, would seem perfectly preposterous to anyone who had not experienced what I had just experienced.
Archivist's note. After repairs to his plane, Arnold made it home safely, and for the next few years, until publishing his book in 1952, kept largely quiet about his experiences. He later ran unsuccessfully for Lieutenant Governor of Idaho in 1962 and died in 1984. 7. Harold Dahl. Harold Dahl moved away from Tacoma after Maury Island and lived peacefully until his death in 1982. He never spoke again publicly about these events, other than to maintain his posture that he had made it all up.
1. One nagging thought I keep coming back to with Harold Dahl. Maybe it was all a hoax, or maybe it wasn't, but would anyone have injured his own son and killed his own dog in order to sell the story? T.P.
8. Fred Chrisman. Chrisman returned to the Tacoma area from his mysterious trip to Alaska, and the following month, on September 8, the Air Force revoked his reserve commission.
1. Suggesting that Chrisman suffered a rebuke or punishment from his reserve unit as a result of his involvement in the incident. I have verified that there were military brigs in Alaska during this period that were used for the kind of off-the-grid questioning more familiar from techniques employed in the early 21st century. T.P.
A few months after his return, Chrisman penned a second letter to Ray Palmer's magazine, Amazing Stories, in which he claimed that sometime during his trip to Alaska, he discovered a second Lemurian-style frozen cave while in the company of a soldier he identified only as Dick, and, once again, barely escaped with his life. But this time, he claimed, his companion Dick was not as lucky, perishing from wounds from a ray gun wielded by whatever beings they encountered.
2. Just an opinion. If it was all a hoax, Chrisman strikes me as the man who orchestrated it. T.P.
Chrisman wrote a third letter to Palmer's second magazine, Fate, in 1950, in which he vehemently denied the Maury Island incident was a hoax and that the crash of the B-25 and the death of the two officers proved it. He also claimed he'd given the two officers photographic evidence of the discs that Harold Dahl had shot on the day he first saw them. No trace of these photos or fragments of the Maury Island materials were ever recovered from the wreckage. Although his military commission had been revoked, Chrisman was recalled to active duty during the Korean War and served as a fighter pilot for 2.5 years. After returning again to civilian life during the remainder of the 1950s and 60s, Chrisman worked as a teacher, school administrator, freelance writer, and speechwriter for many political figures. He also hosted a radio talk show in Puyallup, Washington, using the pseudonym John Gold, usually promoting far right-wing causes.
3. While researching Fred Chrisman, I came across a strange detail that may be of interest only to me. Throughout the 40s and 50s, there are repeated references to Chrisman having a working telephone concealed under the dash of his car. Decades before such equipment was commonplace, how did Chrisman have access to one? Which leads me to wonder, what if Chrisman himself had been the unidentified caller to both Lance and Morello? It wouldn't be out of character if the following is true. TP.
Although this correspondent has been unable to confirm this as a fact, rumors of Chrisman's involvement with the CIA as a deep cover operative from World War II through the 1970s continued throughout his lifetime. If this is the case, it appears Chrisman may have functioned as a handler or black bag go-between, a discreet conduit facilitating access between official higher-ups and freelance field operatives, offering deniability to both sides of any dubious transaction. In agency parlance, these men were known as extended agents.
4. This appears to have been the conclusion of Ray Palmer as well, who tied Chrisman in a later editorial to the assassination of the president of South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, 3 weeks before Kennedy was shot in 1963. TP.
Bearing this in mind, Chrisman later became a person of interest in the investigation of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. When Maverick New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison arrested local businessman Clay Shaw in 1967 for conspiring to kill the president, it was reported that the first person Shaw called after he was taken into custody was Fred Chrisman, with whom he had apparently served in the OSS during World War II. Garrison's grand jury subpoenaed Chrisman shortly afterward. He appeared before them and was questioned about relationships he had with a surprising number of the Garrison investigation's targets. What emerged were a few more strange details about Chrisman's shadowy activities. He had flown back and forth from Tacoma to New Orleans and Dallas 84 times in the 3 years prior to the JFK assassination. He held a diplomatic passport, vouched for by a senator on the Intelligence Committee. It also turns out that Jim Garrison had worked for the FBI after the war, in the Pacific Northwest, at the time of the Maury Island incident. But aside from those details, little came of Chrisman's testimony in New Orleans, and no charges of any kind were brought against Chrisman by the grand jury.
5. The same can be said for Garrison's benighted and controversial case. Shaw was acquitted, dismissed by history as prosecutorial overreach, and remembered more now as the focus of Oliver Stone's movie JFK in 1991. But there's no doubt Garrison stirred up a toxic, corrupt stew of conspiracies, right-wing fringe groups, Cuban exiles, and whispers of unholy alliances between gangland figures and espionage agencies, all hovering around the pale ghost of Lee Harvey Oswald. TP.
At the age of 56, Fred Chrisman died in 1975 at the Seattle Veterans Hospital of kidney failure. An autopsy was ordered for reasons that remain unexplained. 3 years after his death, Chrisman's name surfaced again during the 1977 House investigation into the JFK assassination. A key witness in those hearings identified Chrisman as one of the infamous Three Tramps, a trio of vagrants who were arrested behind the grassy knoll above Dealey Plaza shortly after the shooting. Photographic analysis concluded, and this correspondent concurs, that Chrisman did indeed resemble the shortest of the three men to a more than reasonable degree.
6. At various times, Watergate burglars and former undercover operatives E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, who fit the same shadowy black bag profile as Chrisman, have also been identified as two of the tramps, along with, strangely, a career criminal and alleged mob hitman named Charles Harrelson, now deceased. Before dying in prison, he actually confessed to the killing of JFK, although few gave the confession much credence. He was also the estranged father of well-known actor Woody Harrelson. TP.
Those who maintain that shots were fired from the knoll traditionally believe the tramps may have been the assassins. Although they claim to have been riding the rails and had spent the night in a homeless shelter, all three men were well-dressed and clean-shaven at the time of their arrest. All three men were also released not long after being taken into custody, and Dallas police claim to have since lost their arrest records. Testimony from colleagues at the high school where Chrisman was teaching at the time in Rainier, Oregon, seemed to provide him with a posthumous alibi for 11-22-63. Whatever official role Chrisman may have played as an operative, and at this point the trail is too tangled and diffuse to reach absolute conclusions, there is no doubt he remains a cog in the machinery of many enduring mysteries and conspiracies through the second half of the 20th century.
7. I have verified some of this. In recent declassified CIA documents, Fred Chrisman has an extensive file, heavily redacted, which confirms that he did work as an active agent in the OSS during World War II as a liaison to British Royal Air Force, and later as an active CIA agent assigned as a special investigator at large in the Pacific Northwest. His return to service as a combat pilot in the Korean War was largely a cover for his varied espionage assignments in the region, including Japan. The teaching and school appointments he later took on in civilian life were also selected as ideal cover for his ongoing CIA activities, as was a position he took at the Boeing Company for 2 years in the early 1960s. The list of black bag or dirty tricks style operations he was involved in is extensive. Knowing this makes his motives in the Maury Island case seem more than suspect. TP.
9. Ray Palmer. Chicago magazine publisher Ray Palmer, who died in 1977, adds one last detail worth noting.
1. A personal note on Palmer. For his role in popularizing science fiction through his magazines, Palmer was memorialized by DC Comics, who in 1961 gave his name to the alter ego of a new superhero, the Atom. TP.
Just after the Maury Island incident, Fred Chrisman mailed Palmer a cigar box filled with some of the metallic objects and rocks Harold Dahl had recovered. A few days after the crash of the B-25, Palmer claimed, a single intelligence agent visited him at his office unannounced. If the man mentioned which agency he represented, Palmer did not specify. He described the man as average-looking and wearing a black suit, and that he casually questioned me about the Maury Island incident and the Shaver-Lemurian articles. Palmer said he showed him the box Chrisman had sent him, but the agent, whom Palmer did not identify by name, seemed remarkably uninterested in it, and Palmer replaced it in a locked file cabinet. The next morning, Palmer discovered that his office had been burgled, and the box and its contents had been stolen from the file cabinet, where the agent had watched me place it.
2. Leading one to ask, had Douglas Milford made his way to Chicago? TP.
10. The crash of the B-25. An extensive Air Force investigation into the crash of the B-25 yielded few satisfying answers. For instance, after the two other crew members parachuted, at an estimated altitude of between 7 and 10,000 feet, why did Captain Davidson and Lieutenant Brown not follow them out and instead die in the crash? It's also worth noting that they never attempted to notify anyone by radio that their plane was in distress. Perhaps they didn't have time to react, or whatever caused the fire took out power to the comm systems as well. The surviving crew chief stated that all persons aboard were in readiness to bail out after efforts to extinguish the fire proved fruitless. It seems most likely that a true Air Force man like Captain Davidson stayed with the plane simply to steer it away from populated areas to avoid civilian casualties, and lost control before they could abandon ship, in which case he is not only the first Air Force casualty, but a true American hero. And as to what caused the left engine fire that resulted in the crash? The report concluded, the cause of the fire could not be determined. 11. What was in the cornflakes box? Two types of material were recovered by Harold Dahl from Maury Island, black slag-like rock and the previously mentioned thin white metal. Although the sample Chrisman sent to Ray Palmer in Chicago in the cigar box was stolen, and whatever was in the cornflakes box disappeared in the crash of the B-25, reporter Ted Morello wrote one last story on a third batch of samples that Dahl gave to him soon after the crash for safekeeping. Morello turned these fragments over to a chemistry professor at the nearby College of Puget Sound for analysis. On August 8, reporter Paul Lance wrote about the professor's finding in the Tacoma Times.
Although the rock was found to be common slag, The other metallic substance cannot be explained by any metallurgist. It does not exist naturally on Earth, nor can it be duplicated. The two mystery ingredients are calcium, which in this concentration would offer protection against radioactive material by absorbing radium and titanium.
Although discovered in 1791, titanium was not extracted and isolated from compound ore into its pure, usable form until 1925. At the time of the crash in 1947, it still had few, if any, industrial or commercial uses. Shortly after the B-25 crash, with the advent of the Cold War in the 1950s, both the Soviet Union and the United States began using titanium extensively in military aviation. The U.S. at that point designated it a strategic material and began to collect it at the Defense National Stockpile Center. In both nations' aerospace industries, titanium quickly became a key component in developing rockets, missiles, and craft strong enough to withstand the atmospheric stresses of space exploration. 12. Paul Lance. This tragically turned out to be one of the last byline stories ever written by reporter Paul Lance. A few months later, on January 10, 1948, at the age of 29, Lance died suddenly and without warning. Many years later, the widow of Paul Lance revealed in a letter to her husband's friend and fellow reporter Ted Morello this story about an incident that she said took place at their home sometime in the fall of 1947.
One Sunday afternoon, after we returned from church and we were just sitting down to lunch, Paul was visited by two men, dressed in black, who came to the house and identified themselves as FBI agents. I thought I might have seen one of them before, but I wasn't sure. I left them to speak privately in the living room and went in to make a coffee. A short while later, concerned after hearing raised voices from the other room, I tried to listen in on their conversation, which went on for over an hour. I heard the two men warning Paul to stop. I couldn't make out what they meant by that, but it wasn't hard to figure. But Paul definitely told them he would do no such thing, and that no one could prevent him from doing his job. The two men left the house soon after that, angry, apparently after realizing that their attempt to intimidate my husband into silence wasn't going to work.
Lance, a small, brave man who had survived a serious case of polio as a youth, had made many friends while working the police beat in Tacoma. His funeral was attended not only by family, friends, and colleagues, but by most of the Tacoma Police Department. His tragically premature death remains cloaked in mystery.
1. If an autopsy was performed on Paul Lance, I was unable to locate it. Contemporary accounts state that Lance died after a short, unspecified illness that apparently puzzled his doctors. The official cause of death offered on Lance's death certificate is meningitis, but none of the accounts I've found even mention this. TP.
13. Douglas Milford's shadow. He flickers through the Roswell and Maury Island stories like a shadow. Knowing what we do now, this appears to have been by design, and we can start to infer his intentions. Milford is, by 1947, clearly working for someone. It is, almost certainly, an organization or agency, not an individual. The most likely candidate appears to be the emerging Project Sign, investigating sightings but also suppressing information, intimidating witnesses, and stifling inquiry. At the worst, he's guilty of sabotage and even murder. He remains inscrutable. Was he, like Fred Chrisman, a licensed provocateur, swimming in slipstreams of interconnected conspiracies and double or triple dealing? Or was his purpose more pointed and single-minded? We will follow his trail from here to see what it tells us, and it leads, inevitably, back to his hometown of Twin Peaks.
1. Milford was working for Project Sign, TP.
But first, let me offer an alternate theory regarding the Maury Island incident that is worth considering, which also may account for the strange behavior of Fred Chrisman. One of the first nuclear production complexes to produce weapons-grade plutonium is located at Hanford, Washington. located 200 miles east of Tacoma, around a bare, desert-like stretch of the Columbia River. The Hanford Ordnance Works, often more benignly referred to as the Hanford Engineering Company, is nearly half the size of Rhode Island. In 1942, the government seized this land by exercise of eminent domain, a constitutional right most citizens don't even know exists. Over 1,500 people were relocated from two nearby farming communities, creating ghost towns that exist to this day.
2. Verified TP.
They also removed people of 3 Native American nations, including Lewis and Clark's old friends, the Nez Perce. Yes, this was reservation land, and therefore judged ideal by the powers that be for their purposes. Having fleeced the Nez Perce out of their land in the mid-19th century treaty, it proved even easier to do it a second time. With a world war on this time, patriotism trumped reason. Even the Indians couldn't refuse pitching in to save the world. Once the Manhattan Project split the atom, the B reactor the government built at Hanford produced most of the plutonium used in the bomb dropped at Nagasaki, as well as in most of the nuclear weapons America continued to manufacture throughout the Cold War.
3. Verified TP.
As a result, Hanford also produced a massive amount of nuclear waste, a threat of contamination to the area's groundwater and other resources, before the country had developed a coherent plan on how to store it or contain it. So, what did they do with it? Recently declassified documents revealed that in 1949, soon after the war, officials at Hanford covertly released massive amounts of raw, irradiated uranium fuel into the local environment. Levels monitored in a 200-mile area around Hanford exceeded the established daily limit of iodine-131 by over 1,000%.
4. Confirmed TP.
The water and land rights that had been granted to the Nez Perce were fouled for generations to come. But there would be no relocations this time. Citizens in the area were, instead, routinely tested to see what effect these contaminants would have on them. And in the next few years, thyroid disease and cancer rates soared, at which point officials at every level denied that any radiation above acceptable levels had ever been released. I wonder what Chief Joseph would have had to say to the government about that. In the light of this revelation, is it possible that what Harold Dahl encountered that day in Puget Sound were American aircraft, the size and origin of which I'll deal with momentarily, engaged in the illicit dumping of nuclear waste in the Puget Sound? This could explain the burns suffered by Dahl's son and the death of his dog. It could even explain why the photographs taken by Harold Dahl that day were fogged and overexposed. It appears no one ever thought to test the samples he retrieved for radioactivity. Is it possible that the samples taken on board the B-25 may have played a role in disturbing the electronic systems on the plane, thereby contributing to the crash? When Dahl first went to Fred Crisman with his story, what if Crisman was given an assignment by his CIA handlers to obscure the truth with an even more sensational cover story of flying saucers? Kenneth Arnold's UFO story was all over the local news at the time and would have presented a perfect misdirection. This might explain many of Crisman's actions. Dahl might not even have known his true motives, as well as why the military closed ranks around the whole affair. It might even explain all of Milford's subsequent actions, particularly the silencing of Dahl and the attempted intimidations of Paul Lance and Ray Palmer. As to the flying saucers, there are indications in Crisman's CIA file that right after the war, he was intimately involved in what was known as Project Paperclip, a covert post-war effort by Allied forces to bring to America key Nazi scientists who were involved in Hitler's missile and jet programs. Many of these scientists, most famously Wernher von Braun, became leading figures in the U.S. rocket and space program, which was based at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. In exchange for changing sides, none of these men were ever prosecuted for their potential war crimes.
5. Verified Project Paperclip did exactly that. TP.
But there were a few others, most notably the Horton brothers, Walter and Reimar, who resisted the West's overtures. One of the Hortons and many other hardcore Nazis escaped to Argentina after the war. In the opinion of many, they were the most talented and advanced aeronautical engineers in the world. Late in the war, they had designed a jet-powered flying wing aircraft called the Horton HO-229. Although it arrived too late to see active service for the Luftwaffe, this aircraft was the source of rumors that in the war's final months, the Nazis were developing alternate aircraft, including saucer-shaped and flying wing fighters. It is not hard to study the surviving Horton prototypes and look ahead 40 years to the B-1 and B-2 bombers.
6. Verified, which makes me wonder the following. What if the U.S. got its hands on these designs and was attempting to develop flying wing aircraft of its own at White Sands, New Mexico, or Hanford in the Pacific Northwest? Could flying wing prototypes have been the objects seen in the sky by Kenneth Arnold, Emil Smith, and countless others? And if they were American in origin, could the military have been using these craft, which perhaps had the ability to fly and hover, as many contemporary aircraft do, to discreetly dispose of nuclear waste from Hanford in the Puget Sound? Is that what the archivist is hinting at here? TP.
Many of these same scientists also went to work for the Soviets. Most of the UFO intrigue and subterfuge in the U.S. military was driven by the fear that these unknown and superior craft, suddenly appearing over Western skies, could be Soviet aircraft. If the Russians did possess them, from a Cold War Soviet perspective, the strategy makes perfect sense. Send in waves of technologically advanced aircraft to operate openly over America, against which we had no possibility of defending ourselves, as a way to intimidate us and deflate confidence in our new atomic weapons, which the Soviets did not yet possess. Whatever these craft were, there's no question they created panic and uncertainty in the military. What if the weather balloon narrative out of Roswell was a rushed, clumsy attempt to cover up the crash of one of those Soviet spy planes? Could the UFO stories in the Northwest similarly have been a cover for squadrons of these craft operating openly over our airspace?
7. All sound reasoning except a wave of similar stories about UFOs over Russia date from that same time frame. Rumors also exist that the Nazis recovered a crashed flying saucer in 1937, and that technology recovered from that crash formed the basis of their fixed-wing aircraft program. It's a hall of mirrors. I've also just found a recently declassified report from 4th Air Force Headquarters in San Francisco that there were at least 3 UFO sightings directly over the Hanford site as early as January of 1945, described by the pilot who gave chase to one of them as a bright ball of fire so bright you could hardly look directly at it. The brass moved to install batteries of searchlights after the incident and deployed additional fighters on constant night patrol over the area. At least one more sighting occurred after taking these measures. TP.
There is, of course, another, however improbable, possibility. What about the original conclusion of Project Sign that these mysterious aircraft were of no earthly origin? That their technology was outside the scope of U.S. science, even that of German and Soviet rocket and aircraft development? There are numerous references to earlier sightings of strange airships in 1946 over Northern Europe, then Greece, Portugal, Spain, and Italy. Pilots at the time called them ghost rockets, of which over 200 sightings are on record, all registered by radar.
8. Verified, TP.
Then there are the Foo Fighters, strange flying balls of light and other aerial phenomena, witnessed by Allied pilots that were presumed to be some kind of Axis secret weapon, until it turned out, after the war, that German and Japanese pilots at the time were seeing them too.
9. Verified, TP.
And it doesn't stop there. In the 1970s, a European author named Erich von Daniken, often derided for good reason as a fraudulent hack, provided an authentic missing piece to this conundrum. He connected the UFO phenomenon to the oldest sources on record. Turns out there are even earlier references to sightings going back to biblical times. Check out Ezekiel's encounter with angelic chariots in the 6th century BC in what is now Iraq, up through the Dark Ages and the Renaissance, in virtually every country in the world, including mystery airships that appeared soaring over the American West in the 19th century. Strange tales of abductions, crashes in Texas and Missouri 6 years before Roswell, and massive sightings over Los Angeles in the early 1940s. The point about the whole subject is this. Once you open the top on this thing, the genie won't get back in the bottle.
10. There are, in fact, verifiable accounts of all incidents he mentions, which, of course, doesn't make them facts. TP.
The following is a modern translation of Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 4 through 21, which I somehow missed in Sunday school, if you need something to keep you up at night.
Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 4 through 21. I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, and on the right side each had the face of a lion, and on the left the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upward. Each had two wings, one touching the wing of another creature on either side, and two wings covering its body. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, without turning as they went.
11. I'm assuming all of this is best explained as describing the exterior of an aircraft itself. TP.
The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire or torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels.
12. Okay, I will admit my mind is reeling. It's after 3 in the morning, and I feel like I'm teetering on the edge of a mine shaft. It seems clear that the archivist, by walking the reader through these more reasonable theories and then logically discounting them, is nudging us toward acceptance of the impossible, but I'll need more time to process this before I start embracing meta-theories that shatter the foundation of my Western education and philosophy. I'm going to have to start drinking either a lot more or a whole lot less coffee. Another chapter tomorrow. TP.
Twin Peaks sightings, disappearances, and abductions. 1. Project Sign. Mysteries are as much a part of nature as sunrises. They may not yield to us, but they are freely available for all to wrestle with. The hoarding and withholding of secret knowledge is the trademark of covert societies and governments, for the purpose of concentrating power and resources within a powerful elite, the few against the many. These polarities stand in direct opposition to one another. Mysteries enliven existence. Secrets strangle it. The battle continues to this day, and the flow of information, in any free society, depends on the outcome. Regarding the UFO phenomenon, this conflict was about to be enacted within the U.S. government and military. Our minds are wired by nature to detect patterns. I have disciplined mine for decades to recognize and draw out patterns where none might first seem apparent. But even the untrained eye begins to sense the emergence of a peculiar pattern particular to a specific geographical area like Twin Peaks. A comparable sample size taken from any other similar community's history, I've compiled over a dozen at random as an exercise, yields nothing like the catalog of misfortune in evidence here. The challenge is to trace it, if possible, to its origins. That becomes a search for common threads. One of those threads, in the person of Douglas Milford, we've already identified. Let's follow it. In the aftermath of the Maury Island incident in 1947, Douglas Milford next turns up a few months later at the newly minted Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio for the first official meeting of Project Sign.
1. This document is authentic. TP.
Number 413. File number. Summary of information. Subject. Classified. First meeting of Technical Research and Development Division, T3, or AMC Engineering Project, designated Operation Sign. The meeting is called to order at 0800 hours, December 9, 1947. Conference Room C, Command Wing, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. Present, Acting Commanding General, U.S. Air Force General Hoyt Vandenberg. Chief of Air Base Materiel Command, General Nathan Twining. Director of Intelligence, AFOIN, Office of Intelligence, General Charles Cobbell. Director of Intelligence, AMC, Colonel Howard McCoy. Chief Executive Collections Branch, Colonel Robert Taylor. Collections Officer, Lieutenant Colonel George Garrett. Analysis Officer, Major Aaron J. Boggs. Analysis Officer, Major Douglas Milford. Analysis Officer, Major Dewey Fournette. FBI Liaison Officer, Special Agent S.W. Reynolds. The meeting begins with a report from Lieutenant Colonel Garrett. Lieutenant Colonel Garrett, for purposes of analysis, 18 of our most reliable reported sightings of flying disks were selected for breakdown into detailed particulars. None have been preliminarily explained away as natural phenomena. Each report was assigned a number, and each number appears in the left-hand column of the data on the following pages. 4 reports, numbers 2, 4, 17, and 18 have not yet been fully analyzed. Remarks. From detailed study of reports selected for their impression of veracity and reliability, several conclusions have been formed. A. This flying saucer situation is not at all imaginary or seeing too much in some natural phenomenon. Something is really flying around out there. B. Lack of topside inquiries when compared to the prompt and demanding inquiries that have originated topside upon former events give more than ordinary weight to the possibility that this is a domestic project about which the president, etc., know. C. Whatever the objects are, this much can be said of their physical appearance. 1. The surface of these objects is metallic, indicating a metallic skin at least. 2. When a trail is observed, it is lightly colored, a blue-brown haze that is similar to a rocket engine's exhaust. Contrary to a rocket of the solid type, one observation indicates that the fuel may be throttled, which would indicate a liquid rocket engine. 3. As to shape, all observations state that the object is circular or at least elliptical, flat on the bottom and slightly domed on the top. The size estimates place it somewhere near the size of a C-54 or a Constellation. 4. Some reports describe two tabs located at the rear and symmetrical about the axis of flight motion. 5. Flights have been reported from 3 to 9 of them, flying good formation on each other, with speeds always above 300 knots. 6. The disks oscillate laterally while flying along, which could be snaking.
A lot to unpack here. First of all, Milford is now listed as a U.S. Air Force major. He's obviously been promoted, perhaps for his effective service during the Maury Island incident. Kenneth Arnold's sighting is number 4 on this list. His friend, the airline pilot, E.J. Smith's, is clearly number 8. We also notice that the confounding Maury Island incident does not make the roster. Make of that what you will. Far more interesting to this correspondent are the final two sightings on the list, which occurred in or around Twin Peaks in early September, because the minutes make it clear that the witness to incident number 18 was in the room that day. None other than Doug Milford himself.
2. I've identified a number of high-ranking Air Force officers who claim to have personally witnessed UFOs. They tend, perhaps not surprisingly, to be the most sympathetic among military personnel to the possibility of extraterrestrial origins, TP.
Searching deeper for secondary accounts of these two sightings, a check of Twin Peaks' local biweekly newspaper yielded the following.
Twin Peaks Gazette, since 1922, only 35 cents. Issue 252, Volume 25, Twin Peaks, Washington, Saturday, September 6th, 1947. Look to the Skies, by Gazette staff writer Robert Jacoby.
3. I have confirmed that the reporter for this story is the older brother of Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, a psychiatrist who figures prominently in Agent Cooper's notes on the Laura Palmer case. The Jacoby family had moved in 1939 from Twin Peaks to Pearl Harbor, where the father, Richard, was stationed in the Navy. He and his wife abruptly divorced in 1940. The next year, Richard returned to Twin Peaks with the older son, Robert, while the younger, Lawrence, remained in Hawaii with his mother, Esther, who shortly after the divorce officially changed her first name to Leilani. T.P.
A local resident walking his dog on the evening of September 4th enjoyed more than one of our famed golden moment sunsets last Thursday. Retired mill worker Einar Jennings, 63, was making his way along the hiking trail near Sparkwood and Highway 21 when he looked to the west and noticed a bright, shiny object, perhaps reflecting the sun's dying rays as it streaked across the sky from south to north. The object moved silently and swiftly, said Jennings, and appeared to wobble slightly in the air. Moments later, he heard the powerful rumble of jet engines and a USAF fighter plane roared out of the south along the same flight path at low altitude, close enough for Jennings to read the insignia on its fuselage. It appeared to him that the fighter, which Jennings identified as a McDonnell FH Phantom, was pursuing the first object. Stopping to watch, Jennings said that the first object showed a startling ability to stop suddenly, change directions, and accelerate to top speed almost instantly. The fighter jet, on the other hand, had to maneuver, roll, and turn much in line with what Jennings termed the basic rules of gravity, and as a result had great difficulty keeping up. It was almost like a game of keep away, said Jennings, or an old-style dogfight without any shooting. And it was clear to me that the jet didn't have a chance of catching this thing. It looked to me almost as if this other object, whatever it is, was toying with the fighter. Jennings said he watched this strange pursuit unfold in front of him, back and forth across the horizon over what he estimated was about 30 seconds. At that point, the silvery object simply accelerated straight up into the cloudless sky and disappeared. The jet tried to climb after it, but after some 10 seconds, Jennings said he saw it turn and head back to the south in the direction it had come from, presumably toward Fairchild Air Force Base. At least half a dozen other people on that west side of town report hearing or seeing the jet over our area that evening, hardly a regular occurrence. But no one else has, as of yet, mentioned sighting the silvery object. Mr. Jennings cut short his walk and headed home, although since his recent retirement, friends say he is a well-known figure at local watering holes. Jennings swore on his mother's life to this reporter that at the time of the sighting he hadn't yet imbibed a drop, but freely admitted to repairing to Woody's by the water afterwards to share his experiences with fellow regulars over an adult beverage or two. Whether this incident is in any way related to the recent rash of what some have termed unidentified flying objects across our state is unclear. Our calls to the information officer at Fairchild Air Force Base proved unfruitful with regard to the first object. However, they did confirm that a fighter jet from the base did fly through our region Thursday evening on what they termed a routine patrol. If anyone else has stories to share about this or any other objects in the sky, please feel free to contact this reporter at the Gazette. Your help is always welcome, and your anonymity is guaranteed.
Archivist's note. No other local eyewitnesses came forward, but this article is a clear reference to Incident Number 17 on Project Sign's list, what became known as the UFO dogfight. The pilot of the Phantom was Lieutenant Dan Lerman. I have transcribed here an excerpt from his account in Project Sign's files.
I was 10 minutes into my patrol when I spotted a brightly lit object on the horizon due north of my position, flying at approximately the same altitude. After determining there were no other known aircraft on radar in the area, I gave pursuit to determine its identity. Reaching full power, I realized the object was maintaining the same distance from me and was too fast to catch in a straight run, dropping in altitude by this point down to around 500 feet. I engaged in a series of turns trying to cut the object off, but it continued to elude me with a series of effortless maneuvers. When it went into a sudden vertical climb, I tried to follow until my plane stalled out at 14,000 feet. The object passed out of my visual range, and I returned to base.
After curiosity swelled in the local press, Fairchild's information officer released a statement that the jet had been pursuing the by now familiar all-purpose Air Force standby, a derelict weather balloon.
4. Verified, TP.
Established in 1942 as a repair depot for damaged aircraft returning from the Pacific Theater in World War II, in the summer of 1947, Fairchild Air Force Base was turned over to Strategic Air Command, which made it home to the 92nd and 98th Bomb Groups. Located 15 miles west of Spokane in southeastern Washington, less than half an hour by jet from Twin Peaks, it became home to the B-29 Super Fortress Bomber, a key component of U.S. air defense during the Cold War. There were also rumored to be ICBM nuclear missile silos on the base.
5. This is one of the first of what soon emerges as a clear pattern over the next two decades of UFO sightings over nuclear missile silos, TP.
The second confirmed sighting in Twin Peaks occurred 4 days after Jennings' encounter on September 8. As we shall soon see, this event made the local paper only indirectly, but it is the subject of this report offered by Major Douglas Milford during that first Project Sign meeting at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
6. I'm curious how the archivist gained access to these confidential files and what that tells us about his identity. TP.
Department of the Air Force, Task Force MJ-12, Project Sign, Lieutenant Colonel Milford, Incident Number 18, Field Report. Lieutenant Colonel Garrett. The following report by Major Milford will now be presented by him and entered into the minutes. Major? Major Milford. After the dogfight sighting of September 4th made the local paper, I immediately flew to Fairchild from Seattle and drove from there to my hometown of Twin Peaks. As I had known the sole eyewitness, Einar Jennings, since childhood, he was a schoolmate of my father's and father to one of my own school chums, Emil Jennings, I decided not to approach him in any official capacity, but as an old family friend.
7. If he did not present himself to Jennings as an Air Force officer, he nevertheless ends up performing a similar function, intimidating a witness. TP.
After listening to Einar's story, by now embellished by a few star turns on the bar stool, I gently cautioned him, speaking as a friend, of the dangers experienced by some individuals who had witnessed sightings in Western Washington, Dahl, Arnold, et al., who had afterwards had been shadowed or threatened by mysterious visitors, stressing the case of Arnold, who narrowly avoided death due to apparent sabotage of his airplane. Einar turned pale, and by the end of our conversation, I mentally checked a box beside his name marked Mission Accomplished. Since Einar was among the leading candidates for town drunk, the Jennings clan had long been a no-account family in these parts, and if the rap sheet Emil has already compiled as any indication, always will be. I gathered his tale wasn't gaining traction with locals in any case, particularly after Fairfield issued their weather balloon story.
8. Milford was spot on about Emil Jennings running out a bad string of the local gene pool. In 1964, he passed out drunk and drowned in the steel tub of his basement beer brewing apparatus. His only son, Hank Jennings, one-time football hero at Twin Peaks High, according to its 1968 yearbook, compiled an even more impressive rap sheet in his postgraduate career, including a stint in the Washington State Penitentiary for vehicular manslaughter, TP.
To satisfy my curiosity, the next day, September 8th, I visited the area of his sighting and retraced Jennings' steps. Spotting no physical evidence, I was walking back to my car when a mental image of a location miles away on the other side of town seized my mind with an alarming intensity. It was an area near the Pearl Lakes and the Ghostwood National Forest that I knew intimately from my Boy Scout days. And with it came back memories of a strange experience I'd had there 20 years earlier that I had unconsciously, I believe, long suppressed. I felt compelled to drive and then hike up to the location immediately, and it is no exaggeration to tell you that I almost felt as if I had no choice in the matter. As I ventured into the woods atop a plateau above Pearl Lake, although I perceived no change in the weather, this clear fall afternoon turned as black as night. I heard a strange, pulsating, electric hum fill the air. All other sound diminished, and I sensed, more than saw, movement in the trees 50 yards ahead of me. This was followed by a bright, almost blinding, cluster of lights that burst into view overhead, different colors, red, white, green, swaying and rotating in what seemed to be swift and regular patterns. Alarmed, I knelt down and crept forward behind a felled log and was able to determine that the lights were hovering above a clearing that was illuminated intermittently by the moving beams. From my closer vantage point, I could also see that the beams were issuing from an object in the air, stationary, about 25 feet above the clearing, but below the tree line. I could only infer its shape from the darkness it generated, large and round, maybe 100 feet in circumference, as the lights themselves were so dazzling I had to slip on my aviator shades in order to see anything at all. I believe the shape could have been a craft or ship of some kind, with its power source the pulsating hum that appeared to issue from its direction as well. Then in the clearing directly below this enigma, perhaps because my eyes had adjusted with the darker lenses, I noticed someone standing there. Three someones, actually. Children. Two boys and a girl, each of them no more, I would estimate, than 7 or 8 years of age. Their backs were to me, motionless, arms at their sides, and they appeared to be looking up at the dark shape above them. Within moments, all the varied lights appeared to merge into a single large and steady strong white beam, pointing straight down at the three figures like a Hollywood searchlight, but 100 times brighter. Even with my dark glasses on, I had to close my eyes and look away or risk being blinded. The oppressive hum changed now as well, rising in pitch and intensity to such a degree that I had to cover my ears. Then suddenly the sound stopped, and the beam of light disappeared. It took a few moments for my eyes to adjust, but I realized it was because I was wearing my shades. When I took them off, I realized it was suddenly daylight again. My surroundings now looked completely ordinary. Whatever had been hovering in the air above the clearing was gone. And so were the children. I scoured the area for them but found no trace of anyone's presence. Nor did I come across a single piece of physical evidence indicating that a ship or craft the size of the one I thought I had witnessed had been there. I realized the compelling thoughts that had seemed to direct me so urgently to this place were gone from my mind as well. I had enough presence of mind to use my Minox camera to take pictures of the area, which at this point I realized I knew well from my childhood. I'd visited this clearing a number of times before, and on one occasion had an uncanny experience there. Not far away was the entrance to an ancient cave my pals and I used to explore during our early years, reported to be an old Indian dwelling with ancient drawings and pictographs on the walls. We called it Owl Cave. Seized by an extreme feeling of dread, my pulse racing as a host of unpleasant memories flooded back into my mind, I rapidly left the area and returned to my vehicle.
Archivist's note. So Douglas Milford's personal UFO experience went considerably beyond the other 17 entries on Project Sign's initial list. To conclude with what appears to be the first officially recorded instance of a UFO abduction, or in the parlance of the later Project Blue Book, a close encounter of the third kind. There is unfortunately no record of how Milford's story was received by the other officers in the room at Wright-Patterson. Nor is there any mention of whether Milford showed them any of the photographs he'd taken that day in the woods, or if, in them, he had captured anything of interest.
9. Was this an actual UFO encounter or something else altogether? Milford never mentions actually seeing a craft or ship, only a dark space that he infers is something of the kind. Did he have an observational bias to find what he was seeking? As subjective as it sounds, and given Milford's earlier reputation for fanciful exaggeration, I find it problematic to accept his account at face value. Independent corroboration is required. TP.
2. 3 students vanish. Twin Peaks Gazette, Friday, September 12, 1947.
All's Well That Ends Well, by Gazette staff writer Robert Jacoby. They're safe and sound. The drama that had our town in an uproar Monday evening ended happily on Tuesday just before noon. The 3 elementary school students who had vanished without a trace from a third-grade nature walk safely emerged from the woods near Pearl Lake, a few miles from where they had disappeared, but none the worse for wear. The 3 children, 2 boys and a girl whose names have been withheld at their parents' request, wandered away from their class. By the time their teacher and chaperones noticed their absence only minutes later, a frantic search failed to find them. Word was conveyed to police and the Forest Service, and soon search and rescue teams and dozens of volunteers were combing the woods for them all through the night. A pair of bloodhounds was dispatched from Wind River to aid in the effort. The exhausted team continued their efforts until daybreak and beyond, and were about to expand the scope of their search when, lo and behold, the trio of youngsters were spotted by a sharp-eyed team of Eagle Scouts from local Troop 541 near the Pearl Lake campground. Scoutmaster Andrew Packard and his boys made a game of it and quickly carried the youngsters on piggyback the rest of the way down the mountain. Although hunger and thirst were their only complaints, the children seemed in good health and fine spirits, and were happily reunited with their families. They were taken to the hospital for a quick checkup, where it seems they're all in the pink. According to one source, the kids were slightly confused and seemed to think they'd only been gone for an hour or so, had little or no recollection of spending a night in the woods alone, and were genuinely surprised to learn that it was Tuesday. Yet another testament, as if we needed one, to the resilience and pluck of our local youngsters. This reporter will have more details for you and a longer look at this story in the Gazette's edition next Tuesday.
1. When Major Milford writes how this event brought back a flood of memories and what sounds like the onset of a panic attack, a question arises for me. Did Douglas Milford experience something like a close encounter of his own at this same location back in 1927? The one mentioned in his brother Duane's account where he claims to have encountered a giant and a walking owl as tall as a man that resulted in his falling out with the Scouts Regional Council as well as his brother Duane? Also, no follow-up article appears in the next or any other edition of the Gazette, leaving one to wonder if Douglas paid a subsequent visit to reporter Robert Jacoby. TP.
One other local source confirms the basic chain of events in this story, and also provides a hint to the identity of at least one of the 3 children in the woods.
Calhoun Memorial Hospital, Twin Peaks, Washington. 9th of September, 1947, 4:30 p.m. Physician's intake exam. Patient is Margaret Colson, who goes by Maggie. Her date of birth is the 10th of October, 1940. Obviously female, age 7. Approximately 4'6" and about 65 pounds in weight. Patient has no physical complaints other than hunger and a seemingly unquenchable thirst. After a night in the woods, she appears to have suffered no symptoms of exposure. A balmy Indian summer night where the temperature dropped no lower than 58 degrees helped in that regard. Patient appears to be moderately dehydrated. She drank at least a pint of water while in the exam room, which patient claimed did little to ease her thirst. A physical exam, temperature and lymph nodes normal, reflexes normal, pupils normal, not dilated. No visible injuries or wounds, aside from minor abrasions on both knees and elbows. And this, recently raised or abraded skin on the back of her right knee centered in the middle, reddened or irritated marks that present in straight, thin, symmetrical lines that also form an unusual, but perhaps random pattern, that I would describe as three triangles connected at their center points. Patient says she feels this as slightly painful, but does not remember what caused it or when it happened. Could be a scratch, but it appears more likely to be the result of a slight burn, as if she backed into something hot, although that seems hard to figure given the circumstances. Also unusual, the patient does not remember most details of this night spent in the woods. Children sometimes have a tendency to block out traumatic experiences, but the fact that the two boys also report no memory of the night is certainly unusual. Other similar cases suggest that perhaps memories will return over time. As I was leaving the room, patient asked me if I thought, quote, the owl was coming back, unquote. When asked about this, patient did not elaborate. Seems more than likely the children may have heard or seen an owl in the woods at night, so memory may already be resurfacing. Attending physician, Dr. Dan Hayward.
2. I've determined that this Dr. Hayward was the father of Dr. Will Hayward, who at this time was attending his first year of medical school at Washington University in St. Louis. In 1952, after completing his postgraduate work at the University of Washington in Seattle, Will Hayward took over the family medicine practice his father had founded in Twin Peaks in 1925. He later figures prominently in Agent Cooper's notes of the Laura Palmer case, TP.
Archivist's note. The medical evaluations of the two male children could not be located, but I was able to ascertain their identities. Carl Rodd and Alan Treherne, both of them third-grade classmates of Margaret Colson at Warren G. Harding Elementary School in Twin Peaks. Carl Rodd and Alan Treherne graduated from Twin Peaks High School, along with Margaret, in 1958. The second child. After 2 years of community college in Spokane, Alan Treherne moved to Los Angeles, where he worked for a number of years as a sound technician in the motion picture and television industry.
3. Medical records indicate Treherne suffered from PTSD, and there is evidence he attended a survivors group of abductees in the early 80s. TP.
Before this correspondent could question him about this event in his childhood, Treherne passed away in 1988 from cancer. The third child. Carl Rodd joined the Coast Guard the year he graduated from high school and eventually climbed to the rank of boatswain's mate, serving on a patrol boat under heavy combat during the early years of the Vietnam War. This correspondent was able to locate a photograph of Carl Rodd during his Coast Guard service that suggests he had a similar tattoo or marking to the one Margaret received on the back of his right knee. Rodd was later reported missing while on duty off the Alaskan coast during the devastating Anchorage earthquake and ensuing tsunami of 1964. He was rescued by a Native American fishing crew, but Rodd's patrol boat and the bodies of his shipmates were never recovered. Rodd lived with the Aleuts who rescued him for 5 months while he regained his strength. It was often later said by Rodd himself that he underwent a spiritual conversion while in their company that saved his life, adopting their deist and animist form of shamanism. He married a young Aleut woman during his time with them, but the following year, after her and their baby's tragic death in childbirth, Rodd abandoned the Aleuts and for a time wandered the trackless wilds of the Yukon, British Columbia, and Northwest Territories. He eventually settled in the town of Yellowknife, working as a tracker for hunting expeditions. During this time, he was known to write poetry and songs and occasionally appeared as a folk singer in local cafes, performing his own compositions. He was also hired to perform stunts in a few movies that occasionally shot on location in the area.
4. I can confirm there is someone named C. Rodd listed in the credits for stunts on a 1973 film called Emperor of the North, starring Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine. But it was shot in Oregon, not Northern Canada. The same name also appears, in the same capacity, 2 years later on a film called Rancho Deluxe, which was shot in Montana. Rodd was nothing if not itinerant. TP.
In the early 1980s, Rodd returned to his hometown for the first time in nearly 30 years and took up residence outside Twin Peaks in a brand new trailer park. He eventually became the manager of this park and part owner as well. He quietly gained a reputation there and in the rest of the community as a sensitive, caring, and, despite his meager means, generous soul. He lives there in the park to this day.
5. Carl Rod's new home was the Fat Trout Trailer Park outside Twin Peaks on the way to Wind River, a town that was later listed as a place of interest in an ongoing FBI investigation of some kind during the late 80s and early 90s. It is a classified file of the highest order, and I need time to obtain sufficient clearance to examine it. I also find mentions of Carl Rod in the Twin Peaks Post, formerly the Gazette, dating from the late 1980s. They would occasionally print a small slug at the bottom of columns in the letters section called Carl Said It. Apparently, quotes he would share with younger friends over coffee, a few examples included below, TP. Carl Said It. It's all connected. Carl Said It. What is, what was. Carl Said It. All there is now.
3. Owl Cave. The facts of Project Sign's incident number 18 present many hallmarks of classic abduction cases, which at this time had not yet been widely experienced or reported. The reference made to an owl by the girl, which unfortunately the doctor did not more aggressively pursue at the time, may indicate the presence of what are now commonly referred to as masking memories. That is, a memory constructed by the mind, or, according to some, implanted by an external source, to supplant a real and much more disturbing encounter with something that also possesses oversized eyes. Douglas Milford, as we know, had had his own experience with something in these woods 20 years earlier.
1. A number of indicators lead me to conclude that there is a 96% probability that the dossier's archivist is, him or herself, a resident of Twin Peaks. TP.
The nearby presence of Owl Cave and the numerous depictions of owls in its pictographs suggests that Native Americans in the area may have had similar experiences with this phenomenon during prior millennia.
2. Okay, I have found literally dozens of volumes containing theories and speculations about owls as metaphors and symbols, including one for the aforementioned Illuminati. Screen memories for aliens and abduction cases, guardians of the underworld, messengers of the subconscious, and even more outlandish hooey. There is one whacked conjecture that they show up as harbingers of some weird phenomenon I can't even figure out called reverse speech, which is supposed to offer some sort of window into the deepest parts of the unconscious. Personal bias? I don't like owls. They're merciless predators that have always creeped me out. Ever watched a YouTube video of one gobbling down an intact live rat? That is guaranteed to destroy your appetite for a while. But the notion that three kids stuck out in the woods for a night might run into an owl doesn't strike me as anything out of the ordinary. Even Douglas Milford saying he once saw a walking owl that was as big as a man doesn't seem that strange to me. Some breeds of owls stand well over 3 feet tall and they plump themselves up when they're confronted to appear more threatening. It's dark out there. The primitive brain stem senses danger everywhere. Your nervous system is cranked up like an overstrung mandolin. Your eyes can play tricks. Sometimes an owl is just an owl. Also, the archivist doesn't elaborate here, but it's likely that the Maggie Coulson referenced in this case grows up to become Margaret Lanterman, a noted Twin Peaks eccentric often cited in Agent Cooper's files, whom the locals referred to as the Log Lady. If she is one and the same, it would not surprise me to learn that she once got lost in the woods overnight as an impressionable kid and later developed an entire menu of debilitating mental or emotional symptoms related to logs. TP.
4. Project Grudge. A few months after that meeting at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in late 1947, the Air Force unit known as Project Sign produced a finding for their superiors. Titled, blandly, An Estimate of the Situation, the paper concluded with a matter-of-fact working hypothesis that UFOs were most likely of extraterrestrial origin. This document worked its way up the entire Air Force command ladder intact, unopposed, until the man at the top, General Hoyt Vandenberg, rejected their conclusion outright. Not only that, he ordered all copies of the report destroyed. He also ordered that Project Sign be shut down immediately. It was followed by the formation of its successor, Project Grudge, using essentially the same personnel and engaged in essentially the same work, but with an entirely different mission.
1. Verified. I can also confirm that, although it is often talked about, no copies of this document, an estimate of the situation, are known to exist. Vandenberg never spoke about his reasons for taking this action. TP.
The express purpose of Project Grudge was not only to investigate and report, but to actively debunk any and all UFO sightings as mundane phenomena or outright hoaxes. A public program of disinformation was now conducted using the U.S. media, disseminating the general idea that the whole notion of extraterrestrial life zooming around our skies in impossibly advanced crafts was crackpot stuff. Grudge was a purposeful, institutionalized attempt to squelch public curiosity about these strange and rapidly proliferating incidents and sightings.
2. Verified. TP.
Although Project Sign, through the work of Doug Milford and others, had occasionally been in the business of discouraging witnesses, the debunking machinery deployed by Project Grudge represented a different order of magnitude. For experts in the field in years to come, Grudge would be looked back on as the dark ages of UFO inquiry. While Project Grudge proceeded publicly, General Nathan Twining, at the direction of President Truman, allegedly helped organize and served as part of an insider group of 12 scientists, government officials, and high-ranking officers, known by various names but most often as Majestic 12, MJ-12. This group received the highest level of security clearance in American military history. The order to radically change the direction of the Air Force position on UFOs allegedly came from them, but since any and all public acknowledgement of MJ-12 has been disavowed ever since as a matter of policy, its very existence remains in question.
3. I am unable to confirm whether a Star Chamber panel like MJ-12 ever actually existed, its multiple depictions in modern pop culture notwithstanding. It is a wildly controversial subject and may be as mythical as a unicorn, but it is worth considering that the archivist may be speaking here from first-hand knowledge. TP.
We will return to Douglas Milford and Project Grudge shortly. For reasons that will soon become clear, a deeper look into the underlying dynamics of power and influence in this hometown are in order. Notable local families: Packards, Horns, Jenningses, Hurleys, and Martells. 1. The beginning. Twin Peaks possesses all the traditional sources of information available to any small town: library, hall of records, newspaper. But beyond that also exists a unique and even more insightful resource called the Bookhouse, which will be explained in the body of the next excerpted document. Entitled "Oh, What a Tangled Web," this slender volume was commissioned by the Twin Peaks Town Council in 1984 and written by reporter Robert Jacoby of the Twin Peaks Gazette, which in 1970 changed its name to the more up-to-date Twin Peaks Post.
1. According to its foreword, "Tangled Web" was written in order to set down for posterity the story of our foundational years, while many of this marvelous saga's original voices, however dimmed by time, can still be heard. For which, according to the receipt below from City Records, the town paid Jacoby the princely sum of $150 plus expenses. TP.
Oh, What a Tangled Web, Robert Jacoby. 1. Our tale begins when three families originally tied their fortunes to the fair, abundant forests which mantled the virgin hills and byways that lay between Whitetail and Blue Pine Mountains. James Packard arrived first, eldest son of a Boston shipping family, alerted by his Harvard roommate, one of the Weyerhaeuser boys, about the wealth of natural resources that lay west of the Rockies and north of the Columbia River. Inspired by a vision, Packard traveled west and, moved by its natural beauty and untouched trees, laid claim to 10,000 acres around Whitetail Falls in 1890. Once the railroad built a spur line from Spokane to connect Packard's mill to the Northern Pacific, the Packard Timber Company became the economic engine for the town that sprang up around his burgeoning business. The Town of Twin Peaks. When Friedrich Weyerhaeuser purchased 1 million acres in the state of Washington from the railway interests in 1900, he organized the Weyerhaeuser Syndicate, a confederation of lumber companies that took dominion over his new kingdom. James Packard became one of those partners, and the Packard Timber Company grew along with the syndicate, a beacon of industry attracting waves of northwestward pioneers to seek their own fortunes in the Northwest. One family already in the area wasn't too thrilled with the Packards staking their claim. The Martells, descended from French trappers who'd worked the area's beaver population 50 years earlier, had founded their own modest lumber operation along the river 3 years before James Packard set foot here. Underfunded and outmaneuvered, the Martells couldn't compete with the Packard operation, particularly after Packard bought the land surrounding every side of their 150-acre claim. Bad blood arose between the families as a result, escalating from threats to legal action to an infamous attempted murder in October of 1914. During the annual Lumber Days Festival, Ursel Martell, second son of patriarch Zebulon Martell, and a shady Confederate from across the northern border, Jean-Jacques Renault, accosted James Packard's oldest son, Thomas, outside the Grange Hall's annual square dance. Some say it was about a girl. Others say it started with a slight from Thomas about Renault's rough manners. It ended in a knife fight behind the barn, with Thomas clinging to life. The assailant Renault fled back to Canada, eluding capture, where his fugitive status led him down a wayward path to a life of crime as head of the infamous Renault Gang, which would soon amass a fortune running Canadian